Enemy Sighted, the story of the Battle of Britain Bunker and the world's first integrated air defence system. It's the story of how the coalition of Hurricanes and Spitfires, Fighter Command's operations room and sector stations, radar stations, observer calls posts, anti-aircraft and searchlight batteries and balloon barrages stood in the way Operation Sea Lion, I think we'll call it, Hitler's plan for invading the Battle of Britain. Here to tell us more about it, we've been looking forward to this all day, is Dilip Amin. Dilip, good morning to you.
Charles, good morning.
Now, those of us who have an interest in the Second World War might rightly think, and I'm not going to designate the importance of the feud, that it was some incredibly courageous and brave Hurricane and Spitfire pilots who put Peter Goering's plans to bomb the UK England into submission and therefore launch Operation Sea Lion, the invasion of the UK from Germany. But it was so much more than that.
Absolutely, Charles, absolutely. And Churchill's few is a truism, but actually it was Churchill's many. It was thousands of people involved in Britain's aerial defence. And the Battle of Britain, as you quite rightly say, Charles, was all about invasion. After her defeat in France, Britain was in a perilous state. And what Fighter Command did was buy time to protect itself. And before the Germans, Goering's Luftwaffe fleet could destroy the way and pave the way into Britain, they had to destroy Fighter Command. And so it was Britain's finest hour. And I think, you know, one of the things, don't listen to Dilip Amin, let's listen to Winston Churchill. Because Churchill, when he spoke about the Dowding system, and Hugh Dowding was the person in charge of Fighter Command, who before that appointment was the Air Officer for Research and Development, and he gave his support to the development of radar, Fighter Command's monoplane 8-gun fighters, and then who better to put in charge of the system when Britain went to war than Dowding himself? So it's called the Dowding system. But anyway, Churchill says about the integrated air defence system, all the ascendancies of the Hurricanes and Spitfires would have been fruitless, but for the system which had been delivered and built before the war. It had been shaped and refined in constant action, and all was now fused together into a most elaborate instrument of war, the likes of which existed nowhere in the world.
This is what I like about Dowding, because we always say, oh, well, people tend to think, the Allies don't really, or Britain doesn't really get going until Munich 39, but the UK is getting ready for war a long time before that. And putting these radar systems in, okay, they may not have the hardware in terms of the aircraft or the ships or the tanks or whatever, but they've got something much more important than that, because even though we're numerically inferior, if you can spot the enemy when they're on the way, that buys you time, and time in this situation is everything.
Absolutely, Giles. It was all about time. And when before Louis Blériot crossed the English Channel in 1909, Britain was an island. And she had her navy, the Royal Navy, to defend it. And indeed, in those days, Britannia did rule the waves. But when Blériot crossed the Channel, everything changed. The enemy could now fly across the channel and invade Britain. And it was much, much quicker. And so radar gave Britain those vital minutes to scramble its Spitfires and Hurricanes, and not only to get them to the right height, but as far forward as possible to stop the Luftwaffe before they could carry out their objectives.
But of course, the main thing is, if you're going to launch Operation Sea Lion, which is the invasion of Great Britain by Germany, one of the major things you've got to do is you've got to wipe out the enemy's air force. You cannot do an amphibious operation if there are Messerschmitts, if the Allies are for the Messerschmitts or Fokkers or whatever hovering above you, and vice versa. There's no way that you can land troops on a beach or whatever if you don't have superiority, if you haven't crushed the enemy's air force. So this is the first thing. The Goering's first aim isn't with the Blitz, isn't to bomb London. It's to wipe out the RAF and their bases.
Absolutely, Giles. And on the 16th of July, after the Battle of Britain started at the beginning of July 1940, Adolf Hitler issued Führer Directive 16. And part of it, he says, the English Air Force must be so destroyed morally and physically, it is not able to launch any significant attack against the German crossing. And what the Germans wanted to do when they launched Adlertag, Eagle Day, in August 1940, was to destroy Fighter Command in the southeast of England in 4 days and destroy Fighter Command across the entire British Isles in 4 weeks. After all, that's what they'd done to the Poles, the Belgians, the Dutch and the French. So why not the British too?
And let's not forget the Luftwaffe at this point, 1940, are a pretty crack force. Germany, Nazi Germany, has had a long record of encouraging things of aviation. Hitler, of course, uses aviation when he's being elected. He flies around Germany, and you have things like flying clubs, you have things like glider clubs. So the Luftwaffe and the aims of are well trained. They're not just a bunch of conscripted pilots. They are motivated, and they know what they're doing.
Absolutely. And look, the Luftwaffe were on a roll. After Blitzkrieg, where within 6 weeks they attacked, conquered, occupied Belgium, Luxembourg, the Netherlands and France, they were on a roll. And they were experienced also with their experience in the Spanish Civil War as well, which will be relevant to your listeners. But Britain learned rapidly. It learned very, very quickly. And I guess when you are defending your homeland, then clearly there's great incentive and motivation there.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the Germans didn't know about this radar system, even though they'd been to the UK a couple of years before, hadn't they, and inspected, and they just said they expected radar to be these huge things on pylons, didn't they, sort of 20 foot tall, 30 foot tall. But the radar we're talking about was almost at sort of fence height, wasn't it? Rows and rows of line.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
So the aerial mast, you're quite right, perversely, they were invited to view British defence systems before the war started. But they knew about these mysterious masts, which looked like electricity pylons, starting to be erected along the British coastline, particularly the eastern and the southern coastline. And in fact, they actually sent over the airship, the Graf Zeppelin, at just before war was declared, with engineers on board to monitor the radio signals that were being emitted from these vast electricity-type pylons. But importantly and crucially, the Germans operated their radar on a different frequency to the one that we did. And so they just reported hearing lots of gobbledygook, and their report said, this is not operating, it is ineffective. The truth is that British were actually monitoring the airship as it made its way up and down Britain. And at one point, they could hear the Germans giving their location, and they were really tempted to come back in and say, actually, you're not where you say you are here. So Britain all seeing eye.
Of course, this is all great, but the thing that absolutely wins the day is coordination and communication, because you can't. There's no point having a radar system that the Germans don't know about, and having a great aircraft in the shape of Hurricanes and Spitfires, and having trained crew if they're not all coordinated and they're not all working together. So tell me a little bit about how that all came about, and how the whole plan came in terms of obviously we think about the women pushing the markers around maps. Stuff like that.
Absolutely. Well, look, in my book, Enemy Sighted, I describe and I use the analogy of a spider weaving a web to catch a fly. And I describe Fighter Command's integrated air defense system in those terms, really. And webs have what you call the threads are called capture threads and signal threads. And the capture threads were the Spitfires and Hurricanes and the anti-aircraft guns and balloons. And the signal threads were radar and the observer corps. And the Fighter Command's headquarters at Stanmore in North London, and also its operations rooms at group level and its sector airfields. And it all had its dedicated telephone and teleprinter network as well. I describe all of this Britain had a recognised air picture across the British Isles, so everyone involved in the defence of Britain could see the same thing at the same time and contribute live time. It was like a series of interconnected computers, except in 1940, Giles.
Yeah.
Nobody had designed a computer, let alone an internet, which makes this integrated air defence system all the more remarkable.
And this is the thing, isn't it? Because we seem to think, oh, well, it's people pushing bits of, you know, markers around the place. But it's there's so much more than that going on. And the leaps in technology that happened during the war years between 1939 and the end of the war, 45, are quite incredible if you think about, especially in the air. You think about people training on Tiger Moths, and at the end of 45, we've got jet propulsion coming online, and those are just the things that are working. I mean, all the other things that are in development, it's truly inspiring. Because the mind is focused, to put it mildly.
Absolutely. Necessity, mother of invention, and all that, really. The ladies from the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, yep, pushing those wooden blocks around the desk. And you know, if any of your listeners ever have the opportunity to visit the underground operations room at Uxbridge, please come down there. I volunteer as a tour guide. It is absolutely brilliant.
Is this the bunker? So tell me about the bunker.
This is a bunker. It's preserved now. It's a listed building. And I, along with others, volunteer as a tour guide there. And the role is to bring history to life. When you walk down those steps, you know, you're walking in the footstep of history and history's iconic people. So Churchill, his wife Clementine, King George, Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, the young princesses Elizabeth and Margaret, General Montgomery from the British side, General de Gaulle from the French side, General Eisenhower from the American side, Lord Louis Mountbatten, they all went down the bunker because they all realised the decisions taken and the consequences of those would shape world history.
Quick question. How nondescript is it from the outside? Because they're not going to have big flashing signs, are they, saying, you know, here's the bunker? I mean, could you literally just kind of walk past it without knowing about it?
You could, actually, because it was quite clandestine from above. And in fact, it was described as the hole by the people who worked there because it was a hole in the ground. But Keith Park, who was the commanding officer of 11 Group, the southeast of England, which the bunker controlled, described it as... without communications, all he commanded was his desk at Uxbridge. But with communications, this was world-leading technology. And, it was just absolutely amazing.
And, of course, it's not... We talk about the Battle of Britain, obviously, because that's the Prince of Mines, but it's also the evacuation of Dunkirk. It's the raison d'etre. It's D-Day. It's those advances. It's not a sole-purpose unit. This is it. This is the fulcrum for all British... operations, no?
Charles, you're absolutely right. Now, so there are a number of group headquarters and operations rooms across the British Isles. This is the last one remaining now. But importantly, Uxbridge and 11 Group that it coordinated was responsible for aerial operations over occupied Northwest Europe, the English Channel, the Southeast, the approaches to and the capital, London itself. London, what Churchill in Parliament, using his typical animated language, described as a valuable prize cow tethered for the beasts of prey. And in 1940, London was the world's largest, most populous city.
Talking about London defence, let's skip fast forward a bit if we can, because during the last months of the war, last year of the war, the big problem is A, the V1, the doodlebug that comes over from being launched from Germany, and then the V2, which is even more scary because you can't hear it until it hits. So the bunker is an integral part of trying to monitor that and the fight against these what the Germans call wonder weapons, war ending weapons, they think.
Absolutely. And it's just so finish answering what you raised earlier. Yep. Just to say that the operations room at Uxbridge was pivotal to helping get the troops out of France. You know, it was responsible. Daily during the Dunkirk evacuation, the senior controller there dispatched 16 squadrons of Spitfires, Hurricanes and Bolton Ball Defiance, helping the troops get away. Then in the Battle of Britain, it was responsible for downing three quarters of all German aircraft destroyed during the battle. And then it was the place from which all Allied aerial activity was coordinated in the lead up to and on the day of and immediately after the D-Day landing.
Is that the American Air Force as well then? That's the for all of them.
Absolutely. Look, this was a giant game of three-dimensional chess. And you're absolutely right. For the D-Day landings, under Eisenhower, the commander-in-chief of all Allied air forces was Trafford Lee Mallory, who had been in charge of Fighter Command after the Battle of Britain. And under his leadership, in the underground bunker at Uxbridge, they coordinated the American 9th Fighter Air Force and the Royal Air Force's 2nd Tactical Air Force. So, yes, all American and British aircraft involved in the D-Day landings were controlled from that underground bunker at Uxbridge, which is rather remarkable, isn't it? And, you know, the technology was so ahead of its time. It was as though, metaphorically, the senior controller sat 60 feet below ground to the west of London, could open his metaphoric window and see what was happening over the southeast of England, the English Channel, and on the beaches of Normandy. How remarkable.
Unbelievable. Just quickly, let's get nuts and bolts, because you and this is the sort of job I want. This, you know, you tour people around this. How big is it? I mean, are we talking rooms? Are we talking canteens? What are we? I mean, what's the system? Or is it literally just a hole in the ground where they could just?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's 60 feet below ground, 18 meters.
Wow.
It's a two-story structure, there are lots of rooms, and there's the main plotting room where there's a large map. And again, for people who wish to come to Uxbridge, the actual map that the evacuation from Dunkirk was coordinated from, the Battle of Britain was fought and won on, is still on the table. So that's that. And then there is a large glass gallery overlooking that plotting room where the senior controller, the army, the navy, the observer corps would all sat.
Was this the one that Churchill came to during the Battle of Britain and looked at what was going on, or is that somewhere else?
Yes. Now, so Churchill did go there several times. He came there on Battle of Britain Day, the 15th of September, 1940, when the battle turned decisively in the favour of Fighter Command. And in fact, Churchill wrote about it in his wartime memoirs. And he actually said during the fighting on the 15th of September, he said that presently, I asked, what other reserves have we? Churchill writes, there are none. Churchill writes, the odds were great, the margins, our margins small, the stakes infinite. So Churchill, like the Greek gods on Mount Olympus, looked down through that glass gallery at a burgeoning threat unfold and a counteroffensive rise into the sky.
Absolutely brilliant stuff. And I watched a documentary on the Spitfire a couple of weeks ago, and it was talking to one of the girls who was one of the WAF girls there who was doing the plotting. And she said they knew that Churchill was in the gallery, but they couldn't look up because obviously that would be totally against protocol, but they could sort of feel him in the gallery. So you can imagine the crackling sense of tension and because we know how this plans out. That's why we're having this conversation. You know, I mean, this was, as they say, you know, this was the darkest hour, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And in fact, the ladies around the plotting table, you're absolutely right. They were supposed to change shift. But of course they couldn't, because the Prime Minister was watching, but also they were in the middle of an actual German raid. And they report that after the last blocks had been removed from the table on the 15th of September, Churchill and Clementine walked down the stairs from the gallery to the plotting room, and Churchill stood there, grinning like a Cheshire cat, munching an unlit cigar between his teeth. And he looked around, he took the cigar out from his mouth, and he says, well done. And then he put the cigar back in his mouth, He was led up the stairs by Keith Park, in charge of 11 Group. He says to Park, that was satisfactory. And Park, he reported, was not happy because Park wanted more bombers to have been brought down. But the truth is, all the squadrons sent into the air were able to play their part in engaging the Luftwaffe. But yes, the church was actually there.
How do you, what gave you the spark and to put this, because you speak about this brilliantly. So how, the book had to be a natural thing, didn't it? So what gave you the spark to put the book, down and just not make it about the single, because you could write a book about the room itself, about the bunker, but to bring it into the whole context, which makes perfect sense.
Well, I mean, two things. The first thing is that, I saw the Battle of Britain film and I was a young boy and it sparked something in me, air cadets and everything else. I was going to join the Air Force. When I was 18, I applied for a commission at RAF Biggin Hill. Unfortunately, they said, come back in 12 months. Well, I thought, 18 years old, 12 months is a lifetime. I thought I'd join the police for a year. 30 years later, I left as a chief superintendent, a fantastic career, but with my passion for the Royal Air Force very much intact. And so now, I have the pleasure of volunteering there. And I love telling the story. Enemy Sighted is the first in a trilogy, taking you up to towards the end of the Battle of Britain.
Right.
I'm now working on Enemy Engaged, which is beyond that, and taking you through the what they called rhubarb circuses, rodeos, and ramrods, all the incursions that Fighter Command did in occupied Europe, and ending raid on Dieppe, and then Enemy Assailed, which is the third in the trilogy, is beyond Dieppe, more incursions into France, and then the D-Day landings at Normandy. I love telling the story. It's my passion, and I'm also a leadership and development coach. So I also use this story to help leadership teams in this sort of great, story.
But it's fascinating, isn't it? Because as this technology progresses, as it does, because nothing's so static, and then you see that, and how also the aircraft go as well, how they progress from the Mark I Spitfires through to when we get, the arrival of the Mustangs, where the Americans come in, and the Typhoon. Yeah. And stuff like that. Yes. We have the aerial supremacy, not even superiority, but that enables, and you've got Typhoons roaming around the French countryside, just blowing the hell out of railways and whatever else, and L depots. It is going to be fun. I think we're going to get you back on, Dilip, about this. I can see this becoming a trilogy, absolutely, in terms of interviews. If people want to find you online, where can they find you?
Yeah, please. Just Google Dilip Amin, author, Dilip Amin, and please come on the website, and if you want to buy a copy of the book, you can buy it on Amazon. And if you do, and if you like it, then please leave a good review. If you don't like it, don't bother. But if you come onto my website, then of course I can send you a book and sign it as well.
And just another thing, I mean, if somebody's listening, because we've got listeners all over the world, listeners in London want to come and check out the bunker, how do they do that, Dilip?
Great, yeah, okay. Well, you can just Google Battle of Britain Bunker at Uxbridge. But again, if you go onto my website, and there you can see the dates that I actually visit. I give talks twice a month, and it's brilliant. I get excited. It's my happy place, and to share what the people did there with guests from all over the world is really, really important. And you know what? I think we owe it to those people who, not only the men in their Spitfires and Hurricanes, but the men and women who helped put them there, and it's remarkable story, and I think we owe it to them to keep it alive, because this was Britain's finest hour, and it helped save the free world.
Dilip, you speak about it brilliantly and passionately, which is a heady combination and a cocktail. This book is called Enemy Sighted, the story of the Battle of Britain Bunker and the world's first integrated air defence system. It's by Dilip Amin, who we're speaking to today. Dilip, as you can probably tell, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. Get that second book finished as soon as possible so I can get you back on the show, and we'll talk even more about that. that. But and you can also, if you're enthused about this, you can also order it off our own virtual bookstore on the TRE website. But Dilip, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you, my friend.